This is Focus 580, our telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. During the first hour of the program, we'll be talking about food and cooking. And our guest is someone who has been writing about food for some time, Russ Parsons, the Los Angeles Times food editor. He is the author of a very recent book we'll be discussing during this hour entitled How to Read a French Fry and Other Stories of Intriguing Kitchen Science. And the book is a very interesting way of describing the physical properties of various foods and what happens when you combine and cook them in various ways, and also has a large number of recipes. We'll talk about the book and about food in general, and welcome you into the conversation. Those of you listening are welcome to ask questions or contribute your own stories or ideas. The number around Champaign-Urbana to call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you are listening, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. If you match the letters with the numbers, that's what you get. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Russ Parsons, good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
It's a great book.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun to do.
Oh, I bet it was. I'm curious what got you sort of on the track of this particular approach. Maybe we could start there and as we go along, make clear what it is that that you try to do in the book.
Yeah, the thing that really got me started, I've been a food writer for about 15, 20 years now, and for the first 5 or 6 years, I was doing the kind of stories that food writers always do, you know, talking to chefs and doing those kinds of things. And then I got an assignment to do a piece on why onions make you cry, and I talked to different chefs, and I realized that they didn't really know. And that there were a lot of things in cooking that, you know, it's like you learn how things work, but you don't learn why they work.
Right.
And when I started I started talking to scientists, calling scientists and to try and find out. And it turns out that there's probably not unexpectedly, there are a large number of scientists who study different aspects of food and cooking. After all, it's a major industry and a major concern in this country. And the things that I found out from talking to them were really fascinating. And I found that they had real applications to people who were trying to cook. It wasn't just kind of weird and interesting science, although it is weird and interesting. But it was stuff that actually would help you cook better. And the response that I got from readers when I ran them was very positive. It seems like, you know, there's a tremendous frustration out there with people trying to learn to cook. We're kind of into the second or maybe even third generation now of people who many of whom have been raised away from good cooks, where you learned to cook from watching, you know, mom or grandma or whoever was, you know, the great cook in your family, and people have a lot of questions. And trying to learn how to cook by following a recipe, which is what most people tend to do, I think they pick up a cookbook and then they dabble through it to find a recipe that sounds good, and then they try and cook that recipe, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But regardless, it's not a very good way to learn the basics of cooking, because, you know, a recipe is just a set of directions, and it's kind of like learning how to drive a car from somebody giving you directions how to get to somebody's house. You know, they may tell you to go up 2 blocks and turn left, and then go straight for 2 blocks and turn right. And once if you practice that enough, you can get it down so that you can do that very well. But if sometime you don't want to, you want to go someplace different than that, you're kind of a captive, and you don't really understand why those things are happening. So if you follow somebody's recipe for fried chicken, if it's a good recipe, then eventually you'll be able to make a really good fried chicken. But if you want to make a roast beef, you have absolutely you don't have a clue. That's what I was trying to do, is to provide people with a kind of framework for understanding what's happening during cooking, some of the basic physical and chemical processes that are happening during cooking, so that they can take that into their kitchen and they can, first of all, if they have questions in a recipe, hopefully this will help them answer those questions. And also, if they just want to cook without a recipe, you know, one of the great pleasures is seeing what's in the refrigerator, seeing what's at the farmer's market, seeing what's in the supermarket, picking up things that seem good together and getting an idea for a dish, and then going home and being able to create that dish.
One of the other things that this brings to mind is how different kinds of foods, and in fact, certain kinds of fruits and vegetables, even within certain categories, respond differently depending on how you cook them. And maybe, their shelf life varies, and it's very difficult sometimes to make good choices as a consumer unless you understand what some of those properties are and how you're going to use those ingredients.
Right. Yeah, I really think that once you get kind of the basics of cooking under your belt, and by cooking here I mean heating and taking things from a natural state to a kind of developed state. Once you get those basics under your belt, the real key to being a good cook is knowing how to shop, and then knowing what to do with the food once you get it home. Knowing how to shop is, there are a lot of different aspects of that, but part of it's recognizing that a peach is not just a peach, that there are all different varieties of peaches, and that some peaches are better than others, and then how to pick out a good peach. And then getting it home, what do you do with that peach once you get it home? Because I'm sure everybody's had the experience of picking up peaches at the supermarket that are rock hard. And then what do you do with those? It's certainly not rocket science, but if you get those home, don't stick them in the refrigerator. That's the absolute worst thing that you can do. Chilling peaches that haven't begun to ripen, which is what the rock hard, they're mature because they have a certain level of sugar, but they're not ripe yet because they're still rock hard. Refrigerating them is what turns the flesh really mealy and flavorless. Leave them on the counter for a day or even a day and a half, and you'll find that even at room temperature, that they will continue to ripen. That peach that was rock hard when you picked it up will turn soft and juicy and the aromatic the way a good peach will.
Mm-hmm. Just to take that example and sort of fill in the details, what happens when you put the peach in the refrigerator and it turns mealy? What is going on within the peach?
Well, it's a very complicated process, and in fact, it wasn't even. There's a guy. There's a science called post-harvest handling, which is what you do with food after it's been picked. And the guy who discovered this didn't even publish it until about 3 or 4 years ago. It's a complex set of factors that have to do with enzyme levels and chilling, deactivating some of the enzymes in the peach.
So what you get is an expression of a different molecule in the peach.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what it is. Ripening is an interesting process. I mean, most of us think of ripening as being associated with sugar and with sweetness. But actually, as I said before, in tree fruit, in peaches and plums and nectarines, and in certain other fruits, that's maturity, not ripening.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens during ripening is that the cells in the peaches, let's stay with the peach example. The cells in the peach are lined with cellulose. They're like little cellulose bags holding different kinds of chemicals. As the peach ripens, what is happening is that those cell linings are getting thinner, and in some cases they're breaking up. They're breaking holes. What happens when that happens? First of all, the texture changes because they're not so tightly, it's not so efficient anymore. It becomes softer. When you bite into a peach and the juice runs down your chin, that's a tribute to weakening cellulose more than anything else. The other thing that happens is that as those bags begin to weaken and as holes appear in them or, they begin to fragment, the chemicals held in the different cellulose sacs begin to break together, begin to combine, and when they combine, there are chemical reactions. And that's why, like, when you get a peach that's rock hard, even though it has a certain level of sugar, when you taste it, you taste mainly like this kind of simple sweetness, and that you don't get very much of that peach perfume or the really complex flavors of a ripe peach. after those chemicals have had a chance to combine, and after the flavor develops, the flavor continues to develop. So not only is the peach juicier texture-wise, but the flavor is more complex. There are actually it changes the natures of the sugar change, and then there are flavor and aroma are largely made up of chemical compounds called esters. And what happens is when the chemicals combine, they create new esters. And so the flavor and the aroma of the peach is much more developed.
We're talking this morning with Russ Parsons. He's the food editor of the Los Angeles Times, and he's written a very interesting new book entitled How to Read a French Fry and Other Stories of Intriguing Kitchen Science, just recently published by Houghton Mifflin. We have one caller waiting. We'll get right to and welcome others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with our first caller. This is a listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. My theory about getting California peaches in central Illinois is that the ones you get are masquerading as peaches. I think that they refrigerate them on the way here.
That happens a lot.
And they're always mealy. And
that's a real problem. There's absolutely no doubt about it, because even people in the produce industry are frequently illiterate about how to do things. And even in the best intentions, if that case of peaches has been stored next to the walk-in cooler in the at the grocery store, in the back of the grocery store, in many cases, that can be cold enough to affect the flavor. The ideal rule for shopping for produce is to buy what's local and to buy what's in season. That becomes difficult, and it becomes even more difficult in our society today when we demand strawberries on our cereal in January. That's not what we were supposed to do. And so any strawberry that you get in Champaign-Urbana in January, I can guarantee you, is not going to have been a very good strawberry. It's a strawberry that was bred to produce fruit at the wrong time of year, and then furthermore to withstand the rigors of being shipped for 1,000 miles or so. That's not a very good recipe for a delicious strawberry. Now the thing about peaches and nectarines though is that in most cases, if it hasn't been chilled en route, if it hasn't been chilled at the grocery store, if you leave it at room temperature, that it will turn into a better piece of fruit. It will never be as good as, you know, that 2-week window of wonderful peaches, of Illinois peaches that you get, or the month-long, depending on what the varieties are. But it's available at times when the others aren't. You know, it comes down to economics as well.
Well, sometimes grocery stores will indicate where the peaches are from. And
mm-hmm.
we've had some success recently with Georgia peaches, which ripen earlier, of course, than Illinois peaches.
Well, and a lot of times, you know, when you'll see, it's not even California fruit. I mean, California gets blamed for a lot of things in this country, and I'm defensive about it, naturally. But it's California produces more than half of all of the fruits and vegetables grown in the United States. But there's also stuff coming in from New Zealand, from Chile, from Mexico, from Europe. I hate to put the responsibility back on the consumer, because in so many cases the consumer doesn't have the freedom to make the right choices in this case because of the way the produce industry has become so industrialized. But it really comes back to people wanting everything whenever they want it. And if that wasn't true, I don't think that you would be getting California peaches shipped to you. There'd be peaches that were grown locally that don't need to be as hard to be shipped this far.
Well, I'm asking that they label the peaches, label the fruit, so you know where it's coming from.
Yeah, I think I'm always in any question like that. I'm always in favor of full disclosure. You know, let people make up their minds, give them the information, and let them make up their minds. I'm also in favor of, and this is wildly impractical, but I'm also in favor of grocery stores letting people know what the varieties of fruit are. That a peach isn't a peach. That there are, Alberta peaches. There are you know, at least a dozen varieties of from the Alberta family. I think that the more the consumer knows and the more the consumer's aware of just how complex this is, the better the consumer is able to make the choices that they want. You know, the kind of standard industrial strawberry that's grown in California right now, I hate to say it, but it's basically worthless. I mean, it's sweet and it's red, but it's a variety that was grown to be even-bearing, which means that it produces roughly the same number of strawberries, or the same amount of strawberries over the year, rather than going in kind of peaks where they have to hire all kinds of labor to pick them one week, and then they have to lay them all off the next week because the strawberry the plants are empty. And it's bred to ship, which means that, you know, I was testing a recipe, one of those old recipes that said crush the strawberries with a fork and add sugar. It bent my fork. I mean, a strawberry that will bend forks, that's like the Amazing Kreskin or something. That's not a strawberry I want to eat. But at farmers markets here, and I'm sure at farmers markets in Champaign-Urbana, you can find the old varieties of strawberry, and they're not even all that old. The great variety of strawberries in Southern California now is the Chandler. It's almost unavailable commercially. You have to go to farmers markets to find it, and it was only developed 10 or 15 years ago. But it's a strawberry with great texture, with a real complex flavor, and it's a strawberry that has significant problems as far as the growers are concerned. So it's fallen out of fashion.
We were traveling in France, I think in 1990, and I had read in one of the guidebooks that you could ask at a market for a peach that was going to be ripe at a particular time when you plan to eat it. So I tried it, and I told them I wanted something for lunch the next day or for dinner that night. You don't get to handle the peaches. The seller handles them. And they picked them out, and sure enough, they were ripe when we wanted them. We were camping and traveling by car, so I didn't have a way of protecting them very well or storing them. And it was really an interesting experience. The other thing that I try to do with things like that you buy end up buying hard is to put a banana or something like that with them.
Yeah,
I don't know if that helps with peaches.
It sounds funny, but if you store them in a brown paper bag, that actually helps. And there's nothing magical about a brown paper bag, but it's one of those kind of fascinating little science tidbits where one of the things that happens during the process of ripening for tree fruit is that they begin to give off this ethylene gas. It's a natural byproduct of the ripening process, but it's not only a byproduct, it's a trigger. So that the first peach on the tree starts to ripen, it releases this gas. The gas tells the other peaches on the tree that it's time to ripen too. If you stick the peaches and nectarines in a brown paper bag, the brown paper bag traps the gas so that all of the peaches will ripen at the same time and at a faster rate.
It's interesting to listen to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Other callers are welcome, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Staying on the theme of fruits and vegetables, there's a wonderful chapter in the book looking at the makeup of fruits and vegetables and how one might prepare them in ways that bring out the flavor and so forth. In terms of the physical properties and the chemistry of cooking vegetables, chlorophyll is one of the key ingredients in vegetables and so forth. And
green vegetables, yeah.
Right, and green vegetables. And even, well, there are different kinds of chlorophyll and so forth. What can you say in terms of some general thoughts about mistakes people commonly make that, obviously overcooking is one.
Right, and chlorophyll is a pigment, and there are some pigments that have flavor and there are some that don't. By and large, that's an overgeneralization, but some pigments are very, very troublesome, and chlorophyll is one of them. Chlorophyll is fairly unstable. And what happens is, like, if you've noticed when you cook spinach, for example, spinach is the great offender, and green beans maybe to a certain extent too, because they're things that people cook a lot, and they're also chlorophyll-based, the pigment's chlorophyll. You'll notice that when you cook them for a long time, what happens is they turn from that kind of really vibrant green to a kind of olive drab. And that's the breakdown of the chlorophyll molecules, nothing more. You can kind of get around that problem. Chefs do it by blanching them, which means you plunge them into boiling water, cook them briefly, and then plunge them into ice water to stop the cooking process. But it doesn't need to be all that complicated. What's actually happening is that as the vegetables cook, as they soften, again you get these chemical reactions going on. And to kind of simplify, one of the byproducts of it is our organic acids. The organic acids go up in the steam from the cooking vegetables, collect on the lid of the pot that they're being cooked in, and they rain back down on the vegetables when they condense. And those acids are what turns what breaks down the chlorophyll molecule and turns it olive drab. So if you're cooking spinach, for example, if you cook spinach without a lid on, just something that simple, that will really cut down on that tendency to turn olive drab. Second rule is really, you know, be very, very careful about overcooking vegetables to keep the color really bright. There are other pigments that are similarly troublesome. The pigment that makes strawberries bright red, for example. I don't know how many people have had the experience of trying to cook strawberries, and they turn out this kind of bruised purple or blue looking almost, and that's nothing more than the pigment breaking down during heating. But that pigment can be stabilized by the addition of some acidity, which is why when you make like a strawberry cobbler, you frequently add rhubarb to it. If you add rhubarb to it, you'll notice that the color stabilizes. It stays a really bright red. That's because the rhubarb is so acidic. That's also why when you make other desserts with strawberries, where you're going to cook them, you might add a little bit of orange juice or some lemon juice or something like that to it. What you're trying to do, first of all, of course, it all comes back to flavor, but also, equally important, you're trying to keep the color attractive. You're trying to keep the color so that it doesn't look like somebody just punched it in the eye.
And by the same token, you wouldn't want to cook vegetables with something acidic.
Right, right. Just for the exact same reason. Well, you wouldn't want to cook green vegetables with something acidic.
Right.
If you want to add an acid to a green vegetable, for example, let's go back to the green beans. You know, you've cooked the green beans. You want to add a little bit of vinegar to it, a vinaigrette or a little bit of lemon juice to brighten the flavor. Always do that at the very end of the cooking rather than at the beginning of the cooking. And there are other. Yeah. It's fascinating when you get into it because there are all of these kind of complex and weird combinations. For example, you know, when you slice potatoes or you slice artichokes, and you leave them at room temperature, you notice they turn brown. That's why potatoes, you know, you'll store them in a bowl of water. Artichokes are even more touchy. Store them in a bowl of water to which you've added some lemon juice or something like that. That's called enzymatic browning, and there are enzymes in the vegetables themselves that when they're exposed to oxygen they turn color. And when you're dealing with potatoes and with artichokes, that's a really bad thing. You know, you want to keep that enzymatic browning from happening. But in other cases, the enzymatic browning is something that you really want. And the most, you know, the most common example of that is tea. Tea leaves are bruised as part of the preparation process, and they're bruised in order to encourage enzymatic browning. The enzymatic browning is what makes the difference between green tea and brown tea.
We have a couple of the calls to include in our conversation, and we're a little past our midpoint. Let me reintroduce our guest, and then we'll continue. We're talking with Russ Parsons. He's food editor of the Los Angeles Times, and we're discussing his book, just recently published by Houghton Mifflin, entitled How to Read a French Fry and Other Stories of Intriguing Kitchen Science. We do have a couple callers waiting and would welcome others. 333-WILL is the local number. Toll-free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9222. WILL. Let's talk with a listener in Southern Illinois next on line number 4. Good morning.
How are you doing? My electric just went out, so I'll just listen on the phone and then
okay.
I had a question. You know, I've been hearing that our fruits and our plants and stuff put these different, I think it's a minimum number, about 6 or 7 different types of sugars that are essential for a healthy dietary, whatever you want to call it. And it only puts that in there during the ripening stage. And I was wondering, is that true, or do you know anything about that? And another thing I wanted to just say is, you know, in Homestead, Florida, before they pushed the Freedom to Farm Act, they used to raise a lot of tomatoes there, and they would pick them green, take them to their plant, and look on the chart where they're supposed to be and how long it takes to get there, and then they would put it in a gas chamber and gas it.
Right.
Do you know anything about that? And can you tell me, enlighten me a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, I can do better on that one than I can on the dietary aspect because I'm not a nutritionist. And I don't. I don't want to express any opinions on things that might be, you know, that someone who actually knows something about the subject may disagree. The nature of the sugars do change during ripening. That is true. Whether one is healthier than the other, I don't really know. I'm really reluctant to say anything about that because I don't know. As far as the tomatoes are concerned, you know, there's a. When I first came to California, and I'd drive up the Central Valley, which is where a tremendous number of tomatoes are grown, it kind of amused me because I would see these like open trucks. I mean, huge trucks, like you would for major construction projects, and the backs would be filled with these red tomatoes. And I thought, wow, you know, any tomato that can withstand that kind of shipment, that's got to be a pretty tough tomato. But when I looked into it, what I found was that those weren't even the tomatoes that were going to market. Those were all tomatoes that were going to the processing. They were going to be turned into tomato sauce or tomato salsa or tomato paste or tomato flavoring, one kind of thing or another. And they were actually picked even riper than the tomatoes that we got in the market. Tomatoes that are picked that are grown to go to the market, to the fresh market, are all picked green. They're picked at a stage that the tomato industry or that the farmers call breaking, which means that they're on the cusp of turning from green to red. But I think that most people walking through the fields would agree that it really looks a hell of a lot more green than red. And it is part of that same process as the peach, where if they're treated right, and if they're exposed to ethylene gas, which is something that's very, very common, or if you just leave them at room temperature, they will turn red. They'll never be as great as a backyard tomato. But then again, we go back to that question of a backyard tomato picked dead ripe would never be able to be trucked from Homestead, Florida to Chicago, or from Southern California to Champaign, Urbana. Now, there's a really important thing with tomatoes, too, and that I want to bring up, and that is that tomatoes technically are a fruit. In most cases, that's kind of one of those Jeopardy questions. You know, is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable? But in this case, it really makes a difference because tomatoes, like some other fruits, should not be refrigerated. You should never refrigerate a tomato. If you go into the produce department and the tomatoes are refrigerated, go to a different produce department, because they don't know how to take care of something as basic as a tomato. What happens when you chill tomatoes is, again, it's enzymatic, and it deactivates some of the enzymes that create flavor and aroma. And it's funny to me. It's funny and a little bit scary, but the tomato industry spends an incredible amount of money every year trying to tell markets and shippers, don't refrigerate tomatoes, trying to make that message clear to them. And still, you'll go even to some high-end markets, and you'll see tomatoes in the refrigerator.
So you don't have no way of knowing if that gas that they treat it with is safe for.
Oh no, it's safe. Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want to be in a room where there was nothing but ethylene gas, because I mean, people breathe different than tomatoes do. But it's a gas that will be produced naturally by ripening fruit. It's the same gas that when I was talking about the peaches,
yeah,
that are produced. It's the gas that's produced in the ripening process naturally.
Okay, thank you.
So the gas itself isn't anything, isn't a problem.
Hope it gets the caller's questions. We have a couple other people waiting. We'll go next to a listener in the Chicago area on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. One has to do with what actually happens when you buy, say, hydroponically grown, say, lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
Is that as nutritious and, you know, sort of fresh or not? I don't have any sense of it, and I often prefer to buy the hydroponic lettuce. My second question may not be within the scope from what you said earlier, is I do a lot of sort of bulk cooking, and then I freeze it, say, with rice, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The taste is retained pretty well, but I'm just wondering whether nutritionally freezing really, you know, retains all of the original nutrients. So those are my two questions.
Hydroponic growing means that it's grown, that the vegetables and lettuces and tomatoes are the two most common ones, that they're grown in a water solution. So they're not grown in soil. And in the water solution, the farmers have dissolved a chemical mix that approximates what they think would be grown in the soil, would come from the soil if the plants were grown in the soil. To my taste, I can tell a difference.
Really?
When I taste them side by side, a well-grown lettuce versus a hydroponic lettuce. But then again, a lot of times, we don't have that choice.
Well, it's mostly in the winter. I don't think you want to get lettuce that's been trucked across the country, that kind of thing.
Right, and they're also grown in greenhouses, so they're available at times of the year when, you know, when everything else is covered by snow.
Yeah.
So it could be, you know, in an area, in your area where the winters can be pretty severe, I would rather have a hydroponically grown lettuce that was grown locally than I would lettuce like a head of iceberg from the Salinas Valley that was being shipped in from California.
Mm-hmm.
Nutritionally, again, I'm really hesitant to.
Yeah.
I will say that what we're talking about here are micronutrients. We're talking about nutrients on such extremely small levels that I. Personally, I don't know how important they are.
Mm.
In my point of view, in the United States, most of our problems with nutrition are caused by overnutrition rather than undernutrition. People get, you know, we have much more problem with obesity than we do with malnutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And so worrying about whether you're getting a certain number of phytochemicals or these other micronutrients, I'm not sure that that's something that I would do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But again, I am not a nutritionist, and so.
Okay, so you're saying basically the question about the freezing, your feeling is out of your area.
Right.
The second.
Right. There is some nutrient loss in freezing, but it's very, very small.
I see. Okay.
And since we get so much to eat anyways, that I don't think it's an appreciable difference.
Okay. All right. Well, that's helpful. Okay. Thank you.
Good. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
We have another listener waiting, and this is someone on a cell phone in Urbana, line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Wanted to get back to cooking vegetable question. Is there a difference between cooking in just regular water versus cooking in salt water?
Yeah, but it's a flavor difference primarily. I almost always add salt to the water. What happens again is that when you're cooking something in the water, remember most of the things that we cook are made up of water. When the water in those vegetables or in the peaches or in the whatever, stay with vegetables, or we'll go so far afield it'll be ridiculous. When you're blanching green beans, what's happening is that the water that's part of what's happening is the water within the green beans, in the cells of the green beans, heats up. When it heats up, it expands, and when it expands, it pops those little cell pockets, the cellulose pockets that they're located in. That's why the green beans soften when they're being cooked. That's why the flavor changes when it's being cooked. Now that happens from the big, you know, from the inside all the way to the outside. You notice sometimes, like when you blanch green beans, you'll notice that the water turns green. turns slightly green. That's from the contents of the green bean emptying out into the water that you're using to cook. Now, by the same token, at the same time that that's happening, the green bean is absorbing water that it's being cooked in. Now, to my way of thinking, if you cook them in salted water, what you're doing, and to my experience, it's a means of seasoning the bean all the way through, or seasoning whatever the vegetable is all the way through, because the vegetable is absorbing that salted water. Now you don't want to cook it in water that is in seawater or something that's incredibly salty, but when I'm blanching green beans, I use something, you know, it's about an 8-quart pot, and I'll add a couple tablespoons of water. I'm sorry, a couple tablespoons of salt to the cooking water.
In terms of texture and color, salt isn't going to make a difference.
No, not very much.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting, though, because salt water will make a difference with poultry. One of the best marinades that you can use for poultry or for pork is a simple brine, and that's where you take it's about 2/3 of a cup of salt for every gallon of water, and then just soak the poultry, whether it's a turkey or a chicken cut up or whatever, soak it in that water. Now, what happens is the salt actually has an effect beyond seasoning in that case. And what the salt does is it's complicated, but the simple version is that it changes the nature of the protein strands so that they will retain moisture longer. So I don't know if you've ever, you know, when you roast a chicken, you know, it comes out of the oven and it's, you know, the breast meat is all swollen up and it looks gorgeous and golden and you can't wait to eat it, and you look at it 10 minutes later and it's collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of sunken, and the skin is loose on it now. If you brine the chicken before you do that, not only will the chicken be seasoned all the way through, but it won't lose the moisture, so that breast meat will stay, it'll stay really moist longer. So that was going really far afield from cooking vegetables, but
yeah.
And cooking's a weird world.
Well, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. We have just about 10 minutes left with our guest, Russ Parsons. His book is How to Read a French Fry and Other Stories of Intriguing Kitchen Science. And Russ Parsons is food editor of the Los Angeles Times. We have two people waiting and probably time for others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'd like to comment on the tomato or the fruit in the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happens when you put a tomato or a potato or an apple in the refrigerator, over a period of time, some of those sugars become starches. And that's what gives you that mealy flavor. Improve the way your potatoes brown in an oven by putting them in the refrigerator also. The opposite happens. Some of the starches become sugars there.
Exactly. Exactly, and that's why if you've ever had a really sweet baked potato, it was because of that. And also, you know, again, the browning, when they're cooked, they will brown more because the sugars will caramelize before the starches will.
Now, I don't really know a lot about the micronutrients inside the cell walls or that, but that's a definite that happens. If you take a tomato or something like that and you put it in the refrigerator, the sugars become starches.
Well, that's not quite true in that case. The flavors do deaden. You're right. And it'll never a tomato that's been chilled will never taste as good. But it's not because the sugar has changed to a starch. The sugar will be pretty much the same. It's the other things that make sugar is very simple. You know, sugar is sweet. It's the other parts of the tomato, some of the other chemical compounds in the tomato that give us the flavors that we recognize as tomato-y. Those are the things that go that are deadened and won't come back.
To me, it's always been a change in the texture of it that bothered me the most. The other thing I had to mention was that when you throw that amount of salt into water, regardless of whether you're cooking vegetables or pasta, you're going to change the boiling temperature of that water and you're going to raise it, which allows you to cook those vegetables faster, which should save some of the flavor.
Well, you know, technically that's true. That adding salt to water will raise the boiling temperature, but but actually the amount of salt that you would have to add to the water to have an effect of more than a degree or two would be pretty phenomenal. It would be much more than you'd want to add flavor wise. So that is kind of true, but it would be a small amount.
If you're charged,
it was something. You know, the thing that will do. The problem is that whenever you cook anything in water, that water boils at room at sea level at 212 degrees, and there's nothing that you can do to fix that. So that things that are cooked in water, for example, meat that's cooked in water is never going to brown because the browning reactions, the chemical reactions that create browning, don't occur until about 300 to 350 degrees. The one exception to that is a pressure cooker, because the pressure cooker effectively lowers the altitude so that the water inside can get hotter than 212 degrees.
You never want to pressure cook meat. That's terrible.
I agree completely.
What you could do is put
scientifically interesting, but culinarily invalid.
You put your meat and your shoe in the pot, and then have a guessing game as to which is which.
Exactly. I'm afraid I agree with you as far as that's concerned.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. But the thing you mentioned about meat, if you want it to brown, you suggest that you should try to dry it off before you cook it.
That's really important when you're sautéing meat or when you're grilling meat. That you just pat it dry with a paper towel before. Before you begin to cook it, because what happens is, as long as there's moisture on the surface, the temperature won't get above 212 degrees. Now, you know, that moisture will evaporate when it's heated, you know, when you're cooking it. But it'll change the texture of the meat in the process, because it'll steam the surface. And it's a fine difference. But if you have trouble like getting a great crust on your steak. You might try doing that, or if you have trouble getting really crisp skin on sautéed chicken or something like that, you might try next time patting it well dry before you put it in, and see if that doesn't make a difference.
Good. We have a couple callers and about 5 minutes left. We'll try to get them both in. Next up, a listener on a cell phone on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to – you mentioned don't ever pressure cook meat. I would say in general that's true, but for some meat, it actually, in my opinion anyway, seems to help it a fair amount. For instance, instead of parboiling ribs, I will pressure cook them, and it seems to take most of the fat out of them pretty well, and they cook much quicker and seems to tenderize them. I don't know. So
are you talking about beef ribs or pork ribs?
Pork ribs? Beef ribs are, yeah.
Yeah, I agree completely. Those are way too fatty. It's one of those, the thing with ribs and with some other cuts of meat is that they're really high in connective tissue.
Right.
The muscles that are used a lot are high in connective tissue. And that connective tissue is kind of that stringy, gristly stuff. Ribs are high in that. So somehow you need to soften it. One of the things that happens is when the connective tissue gets to about 160 degrees, when it's heated to about 160 degrees, that's the internal temperature of the meat, those connective tissues melt into the meat, and they give it flavor, and they keep it moist. There are different ways that you can do that. You can do it in a pressure cooker, and that'll drive the heat through the meat very quickly. When I cook ribs, and I just did this weekend, I cook them in a slow oven first for like 2 hours. You know, I did two racks of ribs. I put a really good a thick coat of rub on them, and I put them on a baking sheet and baked them at 250 degrees for 2 hours, turning them once. And then I finished them by putting them on the grill over a slow fire. And cooking them slow that way, I found it gave it it rendered a lot of the fat out of it. But it made them tender in the way you can all. I'm a barbecue freak, so you know this may be more than anybody wants to know. But you can tell. I can always tell pressure cooked or boiled ribs, because the meat comes away. It pulls away from the bone too easily. With ribs that have been truly barbecued and cooked over low heat for a long time, the meat will pull away in one piece, but it doesn't pull away so easily. There's a difference.
I know what you're saying.
Outside of the meat will have a good crust on it, as opposed to being kind of soft.
No. I know what you're saying. I wouldn't necessarily say pressure cooking it is the best way to do it, but
yeah.
If you happen to be in a rush,
yeah, right.
Do you want to get dinner on the table and get it done? It also seems to work for things like spaghetti sauce and that sort of thing. Where
yeah, I mean pressure cooking. If you're in a hurry, pressure cooking is great, and it'll work for meat. But what I find pressure cooking really useful for are cooking like dried beans and things like that that normally take 2.5 hours to soften. If you cook them in the pressure cooker, they'll soften much more quickly. And I really don't notice any flavor loss with pressure cooking those things.
But I found that to be really useful for someone who's in a rush, I guess.
Absolutely.
A good way of characterizing myself. But that's right. Not everything can be cooked in a pressure cooker.
A man in a hurry.
Well, all right. Thanks
for the call. I'm sorry to say that we're running out of time here, and there's a lot more we could talk about, including the first chapter on frying, which I really wanted to get into. But, you know, sort of as a thought to leave for folks, it seems like a lot of this is essentially understanding. You are taking ingredients which are changing by themselves, but you're also applying processes, heat, combining them in ways that create chemical reactions and so forth. And if you understand what those reactions are and what changes you're trying to make, you'll be a better cook.
Right. And the thing I want to make really clear is because a lot of times when you discuss the details and the specifics of this stuff,
you get
really down into a lot of scientific detail. And what I was very conscious of doing with this book is understanding as much as I could all of that detail, but then taking it out of the book, so that in the book there are very few actual chemical terms. I promise there are no formulas to memorize.
No quadratic equations, right?
This is definitely a cook looking at science rather than a scientist looking at cooking. I think it's something that I ran it past several people without scientific backgrounds just to have them read it and to give me their feedback. And it's a book that people who aren't even interested in science have found interesting.
And it's got a bunch of great-looking recipes in it as well.
Well, thank you.
I must say. And the other thing I wanted to just mention is that the LA Times website is really quite outstanding. And the food section in the LA Times, I wish we had something like that here. Of course, we're not as big a city, but... it certainly looks like an outstanding job you're doing there.
Well, thank you. And a good food section is a pretty expensive proposition. All of our stories are written for us. All of the recipes are tested in our test kitchen. All of the photography is done in our test kitchen. And so the Los Angeles Times, I mean, the organization itself deserves a lot of credit for that, because they're the ones who are ponying up the dollars that allow us to do that kind of work.
Well, real good. We're out of time, so we'll have to stop. Our guest has been, again, Russ Parsons, the LA Times food editor, and his book is How to Read a French Fry and Other Stories of Intriguing Kitchen Science, just recently published by Houghton Mifflin. Russ Parsons, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.